Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Welcome to Murder and Mimosas, a true crime podcast brought to you by a mother and daughter duo.
Bringing you murder stories with a mimosas in hand.
Just a quick disclaimer before we get started. Our show is Murder and Mimosas. It's a true crime podcast. This means that we do discuss crimes, including but not limited to disappearances, murder, and sexual assault. All our episodes are told with the respect of the victims and the victims' families in mind. We strive to ensure that we provide factual information, but some information is more verifiable than others. With that, grab your mimosas and let's dive in.
Welcome back. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Danica.
Today, we're going to tell you about the story of the Flint River Killer. So grab your mimosas and you sip while we share.
Hang on, Shannon. Before we get into that, we have a reminder for our listeners. We will be at the Garland County Library in Hot Springs, Arkansas, the first weekend in November. You can come out and see us and have a mocktail with your favorite murder and mimosa gals. You may continue now.
Okay. Thank you. So, all serial killers seem to have someone in love. Have you ever wondered what would happen if someone killed a serial killer's loved one?
That's interesting.
Today, we're going to talk about just that, and it has lots of parts, so try to keep up. It's December 1977, when two men are wading out into the Flint River in Georgia to duck hunt. The river is 344 miles long, and how it looks depends on what area you're in, really. These two men happen to be in what I would describe as a swampy area. It has many cypress trees growing from the river, and they are draped in moss, a place you should be shocked to find an alligator roaming around. Their hunting day comes to a halt, though, and they find a badly decomposed body in the river. Police fish 45-year-old Betty Jo Eflin out of the river in Clayton County.
All right, you mentioned alligators, so could it be that she's in the water because she didn't die of drowning?
No, she did not. However, these hunters were wading around in it, and there are parts of the river people swim in. I just wouldn't advise swimming in this particular area, nor would I want to wade around in it. They can't tell what her cause of death is right away. That she is nude, wrapped in a plastic bag, and weighed down with a cinder block.
I mean, I don't think alligators did that, so it seems kind of obvious that this is a homicide.
Right. And they will find out she was shot twice in the head. Sheriff Randall Johnson was supervising from the bridge and spots something red on the other side of the river that gets his attention. He yells down at the men, "Check that out, too!" The men go to the other side of the river to find a red sleeping bag. In the bag is 31-year-old Liddy Evans. She's weighed down as well with a cinder block. She is clothed, though. However, the crotch of her pants has been cut out. They can tell they were killed at different times because her body is not as decomposed as Betty Jo's.
This is giving me, like, Green River Killer vibes. Are these ladies sex workers, perhaps?
No, they actually aren't. Betty Jo had recently gotten married to 45-year-old Fred Wyatt. Fred was a truck driver who also hauled marijuana and sold it as his little side hustle. Fred wasn't the greatest of men. It's said that he actually was abusive to Betty Jo. Betty Jo was a mother of three. She was in the trucking industry and apparently didn't run in the best crowds, but people loved to be around her.
Okay, so she recently married a guy who's stealing drugs out of his truck, who beats her. So I'm now getting some, like, life insurance scam vibes.
It does sound like that, doesn't it? But no, and we'll talk about that a little bit later and about Fred soon. Liddy had a live-in boyfriend, which was 28-year-old Joe Cleveland. He was a firefighter in town and also pretty shady from what I could gather.
Hi, guys. I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And we are the hosts of The Book of the Dead, a true crime podcast based out of New Jersey, where we tell you about the most obscure cases that you may have never heard of. So join us in the Book of the Dead library for another chapter of The Book of the Dead wherever you get your podcasts. Bye, guys.
The odd thing about this is that both women are on opposite sides of the river. So their cases are worked by two different counties due to how the county lines run. While they are two separate investigations, the police will work together some too. Clayton County Police are trying to get in touch with Fred Wright to let him know his wife was found.
Had he reported her missing, or anyone reported her missing for that matter?
He hadn't reported her missing. Her daughter that lived in Texas actually reported her missing. Fred returned back from trucking and Betty Jo wasn't there. He called her daughter to see if she had gone back to Texas, but she wasn't there. The police realized they can't find Fred because he had been in a train accident on November 12, 1977. His car was sitting on the tracks and ran down by a train.
Wow, okay. I'm guessing not murder-suicide, though, because Liddy is part of this equation and she's also murdered fairly recently, so I'm assuming that couldn't have been Fred.
Right. Fred was already dead when Liddy was murdered. Here's the thing, though. They get to looking at the photos of his car on the track and how he's positioned in the car and decided maybe he wasn't actually killed by the train after all. So they decide to exhume his body for an autopsy. The autopsy shows that Fred had been shot behind the ear. He was dead when the train hit him, and the whole thing was staged to look like an accident.
Okay, I'm not a mortician, but it seems to me that they might would have noticed blood coming from there, or at least the people who removed his body. Well, I don't know. I feel like a train accident's probably pretty bloody. But did they not do an autopsy?
No, they didn't do an autopsy then, but I mean, I would think you would see, I don't know. But there wasn't an autopsy done then. There was one done later after he was exhumed. But I would think that first responders or whoever pulled him from the train would see, like, the bullet hole. But then again, there could have been so much blood at the time and so much damage to his body that you just don't know.
Yeah, at least they had, enough sense to go back and look back into it and see that they made a mistake.
That's true, because people hate to make sure that they make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So as they're trying to look into Fred more, they see he had $13,000 life insurance payout, but it wasn't for Betty Jo. It was for Maria Wyatt.
Okay. Is that his daughter or something since they have a last name?
No, this was actually his ex-girlfriend. They never married, but they did live together. They were together for about 4 years, and she ended up taking his last name. While they were still living together, Fred began seeing Betty Jo and then left Maria in July to marry Betty Jo.
Ouch. That's going to hurt. Living with this guy for 4 years, doesn't marry you, but runs right off and marries this other woman. I mean, of course, she wanted to get married. That would have not been the case at all.
No, that was the case, all right. She did want to marry Fred. I have no idea why, because he was abusive to her, too. But that's what she wanted, and I'm sure it really stunned for him to take off and get married to this woman in no time. So to the police, she seems like a good suspect for Betty Jo and Fred's murders.
I mean, they have a whole series called Love Scorn, so we know scorned people are capable of things they wouldn't ordinarily do.
Yeah, and it can make you go a little nuts at times. She realizes they are looking at her, and she tells them the list of people that may want Fred dead is pretty long. After all, he was in the drug business, and he had a way of rubbing people the wrong way. She tells them to talk to 27-year-old Carl Patton. He's Fred's nephew and also his enforcer. It was also rumored that Fred was a member of the Dixie Mafia.
The Dixie Mafia? Really?
Yeah. So do you know what that is?
I know a little bit about it. It's basically a group of men that banded together in the southern states in the United States to do criminal activity, one of which the drug business. I mean, really, they're like any other mafia. That's just they're in the South.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the gist of them. And I don't have any definitive proof if Carl was in the Dixie Mafia, but I'm sure the rumor mill didn't hurt if he was Fred's enforcer. So police are looking for Joe Cleveland so they can question him since he and Lydia live together. They can't find him anywhere. They begin questioning friends and family. And as I said, they knew that Joe and Lydia were going camping in Panama City with Joe's best friend and wife, Carl and Norma Patton. Don't forget, I mentioned that two different counties are working these cases, but they did call each other to go over the case, and both have Carl Patton come up in each case. The police decide to pay Carl and Norma a visit. Both counties go together to talk to them. They are asked about their camping trip, and they planned with Joe and Liddy. They tell the police that the two of them were fussing and fighting, and they didn't want them around. They didn't need that kind of vibe bringing them down by those two. The police ask, can they look around? They find blood in Carl's truck, which is type O. They find blood on a pillow, which is type A, and a sleeping bag similar to what Liddy was found in. This being in 1978, all they could do was match the blood type. Liddy had type A blood, which is fairly rare, and that matched the pillow. However, they don't know if all this is enough to get a conviction on them. The cases all go cold for years. In 2003, a detective begins working on some cold cases, and he sees a picture of the pillow with blood. He knows right away if he can locate that pillow and test the DNA, then he just solved at least one case.
I love the technology of DNA now. We have so many people that have gone their whole lives thinking that they're getting away with murder when, bam, they're busted.
With the help of DNA, the blood matches Liddy. And the blood they found in Carl's trunk, it matches Joe. The police decide, let's just head out to their house and see if they feel like confessing today.
Are Carl and Norma actually still married at this point?
They are, actually. They question both of them separately and tell them what they have on them. Norma starts telling it all. She said Maria, who you remember was Fred's longtime girlfriend, asked Carl to kill Fred, and she would pay him some of the insurance money. I mean, she's bitter. He left her, and she doesn't deserve this kind of breakup, right?
Okay, this is Carl's uncle, though, and they work together. I'm also using work together loosely. It seems like an unlikely person to ask.
Carl had actually known Maria for years, even before she began dating Fred, and she was like a mother figure to him. He had seen Fred beat her, which he hated, but not only that, he thought Fred was stiffing him on some of the money from the drug deals. So killing him, you know, I mean, why not?
Okay, but why Betty Jo, though? I would think that she would like her to suffer not having him.
Betty Jo was never part of the plan. Carl and his friend Joe, that went missing, went over to Fred's house. Carl had told his buddy Joe he was going to kill his uncle and needed his help. Like any ride or die friend, he's like, okay, I'm in.
I don't have any ride or die friends like that.
Have you asked anyone to help you commit murder before?
On the record, no.
It sounds like you don't know then if you have any ride or die friends like that. So they get to Fred's and he is out on the road working, but Betty Jo invites them in. Carl says while they are there, Joe takes his gun out and shoots Betty Jo, and they put her body in the river. His uncle suspects that Carl has something to do with Betty Jo being gone, but Carl adamantly denies this. Of course, Carl is the one that has to be taken out, so he asks his uncle if he wants to go fishing. It's unclear if they ever actually go fishing, but they do go out and shoot cans for target practice. While doing that, Carl shoots him and calls his friend Joe to help him stage the train wreck. Joe was his best friend, but he felt like Joe had told Liddy about what they had done, and you know what they say.
Loose lips sink ships.
Right, which means he needs to take them both out. If he doesn't, he's going to prison.
Wait, isn't Norma telling the police all this?
Yes.
I take it that doesn't apply to him?
Partly. I'm sure, but he also told Norma because he wanted her help with Joe and Liddy.
No, I see. Now she's an accomplice.
They have them over, and she says both Joe and Carl have guns out playing with them, and Carl shoots Joe and Liddy. He tells Norma to get stuff to clean up, which she's doing that as he rapes Liddy. Now, I can't be sure if he told her that or if it came out when he was questioned by the police. They get the bodies and they go dump them. I didn't mention it, but Joe's body was later recovered in another river. They dump Liddy in, of course, the Flint River. Carl takes whatever he can of theirs and he burns it in the backyard. Norma turns state evidence and testifies against Carl for immunity. Carl, when questioned, though, tells the police of another murder he's responsible for. He tells them that this wasn't the first time Maria had asked him to kill for her. She asked him to kill her husband, Richard Jackson. She offered him money from the life insurance if he would do it. And he was also abusive, just like Carl, so he didn't have a problem doing this.
I don't know if she was picking really crappy guys or if they were picking really crappy women, seeing as how they're both dead.
I guess she had a type, abusive, if that was actually the case. She's passed away by the time this all came out. So she was never charged with either murder, and she was never there to be questioned about any of this. So we just have Carl's word on that. So Carl ends up sentenced to life in prison, and I'm sure you're thinking that's where we end. But wait, there's more. Remember how I asked, have you ever wondered what would happen if someone killed a serial killer's loved one? That's where we go now. Carl and Norma had two daughters together, Tina and Melissa, 7 years apart. Melissa was a quiet and shy girl, but she began seeing a boy named Chris Wolfenberger in high school, although her parents didn't exactly like him.
Was there a reason they didn't like him, since her parents were clearly such upstanding citizens?
Well, Norma said he was a bad influence on Melissa. With him, she would sneak out of her window to see him, and at one point in 1994, she ran off to Oklahoma with him. Norma had called and reported this, and the two ended up married as soon as she graduated, and they had two children by the time Melissa was 21. The two moved to Atlanta and were raising a daughter and a son. The last time Melissa's family recounts having any contact with her was by a telephone call on Thanksgiving in 1998. They talked about how they would spend Christmas, and Melissa asked her mother for a picture of herself and her papa for Christmas. Christmas, however, came and went, and the Wolfenbergers didn't show up for the holidays, not so much as even a phone call. By January, her family decides they should go to their house and see what's going on, since they hadn't heard anything from them at all.
Okay, I realize our family is a little much at times, but I can't see our family waiting until January.
From what they said, this wasn't out of the norm for her not to show up for a holiday or anything. So, not that she didn't want to, but at times she didn't show up because of lack of transportation or just lack of money for gas. She also didn't always have a phone either to be able to call and let her family know that she couldn't make it. So for her family, this wasn't really out of the realm of possibilities. Her family did travel from Locust Grove to Atlanta to check on the family in January.
How far apart is that?
It was right outside of Atlanta, so depending on what areas, at the most, I'd say like 35 miles, give or take. Her family gets to the duplex they lived in, yet it's completely cleaned out. Her family talks to the neighbors, and they tell them the family up and moved sometime between Christmas and New Year's. Of course, they're a little taken aback, but maybe they didn't have time for Christmas if they were in the process of moving.
Right, but it seems odd you just moved during the holiday season and you don't mention this to any of your family, and now they don't even know where you are.
That's true. This was before cell phones, so if you move, you have a totally different number if you have a phone at all. I guess the only plus side to this is that you could call information to request a telephone number, but you still needed to know what town they were in. So Norma, Melissa's mother, decides she's going to file a missing persons report when she gets home. However, they don't live in the same city or even county. The police tell her she can't file a missing person report in Henry County. She has to go to Atlanta, so she does. In Atlanta, the police tell her that she's a grown woman. She can go missing if she wants. They tell her that her husband hasn't even filed a missing person report. So, of course, why should she?
Seriously, the police don't even let her file one?
They sure don't.
Do we know anything at all about their marriage? What is it, a good marriage, a healthy marriage, a stable marriage, an abusive marriage?
Well, Melissa had left him once, but only for maybe a week. She went back because of the kids. There are documents reported of police reports of domestic violence on both parties. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say they don't have the best marriage. It does later come out down the road when Chris moves, he changes his name.
I mean, that's not suspicious at all. Does he ever report her missing?
No, never. In other news, in April 1999, on Avon Avenue, a skull is found in a trash bag. They don't have anything to compare this to, such as dental records, but Atlanta police reconstruct the face and determine it's a male. The police also find another trash bag on June 3rd, 1999, that has limbs in a wooded area, and the site is close to Avon Avenue. Years pass. Carl is now sitting in prison, and he and Norma decide they should ask Major Bruce Jordan if he could find Melissa. Carl says he must be a pretty good officer if he found them or him after all these years. Norma goes and asks him, and he says, "Of course I'll look into this." One of the first discoveries he makes is that Chris worked at Action Glass on none other than Avon Avenue.
The same street that the skull was found on?
Yes. Not only that, but he was also fired from his job for stealing a receptacle saw. March of 2003, they get the dental records of the skull and have them tested, and it turns out to be Melissa. Police do question Chris. He swears he didn't hurt Melissa, and he has no idea where she is. He does tell police she had taken an extra shift at Waffle House back in the day because they were wanting to save money and change their names and move to California. He just assumed Melissa had done this without him.
Okay, hang on. Let me try and get this story to make sense. Her abusive husband just lets her leave without a trace. She just doesn't come home one day, and his first assumption is she's changed her identity and moved to California.
Yes, but you forgot that he calls no one. He doesn't call her family to see if she's there, even though she had done that once. He doesn't file a police report. I guess he never plans on her trying to find them since he changes his name and moves right after this. Oh, yeah, and they only have one car, so she doesn't have one. She didn't take her money from the extra shifts, so she doesn't have any money. And her mother said she would never, ever leave her kids.
Okay, I know that you probably know the next thing I'm going to ask is motive. Is there life insurance?
No, there wasn't any life insurance. I could only speculate that maybe the domestic abuse got out of hand and he accidentally killed her. That is only my speculation, and he was never arrested for that.
Did her family suspect Chris before her dad Carl went to prison?
Yes, her mother and sister I know did. They were also fully aware of the domestic abuse.
Not gonna lie, I can't believe that Carl didn't deal with his son-in-law and take him out once she went missing.
Right. I have to say, I'm kind of surprised too. Maybe he was just older and decided he couldn't handle a younger man. I really don't know.
Go.
The crazy thing is that had Carl not been arrested, that skull may have never been looked at again. Melissa's case sat cold for years. Actually, the police weren't doing anything because they didn't think there was even an issue.
Okay, I know this is a bit morbid, but did this girl really marry a guy like her father? I mean, what are the odds?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy and screwed up. But Carl has since said that losing Melissa put things in perspective for him, and he really regrets what he did to other people's families.
I wonder if that's part of the reason, like, why he didn't go after Chris, is because he didn't want to hurt his grandkids and Chris's family.
It could be. Who knows? There still isn't justice for Melissa, so if you do know anything that could help, please call the Atlanta Crime Stoppers at 404-577-8477.
And this month of October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which is, as you can see in this episode, all over the place. So if you are dealing with domestic violence yourself or someone you know and you need help, the National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 800-799-7233. We always recommend more bubbly
and less OJ.
Cheers! If you'd like to see pictures from today's episode, you can find us at murder.mimosas on Instagram. You can also find us at murder.mimosas on TikTok, Twitter. And if you have a case you would like us to do, you can send that to murder.mimosas@gmail.com. And lastly, we are on Facebook at Murder and Mimosas Podcast, where you can interact with us there. We love any type of feedback you can give us, so please rate and review us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.